Welcome once again to Superhero Stuff You Should Know. It is once again the Ben Man here with my co-host.
Andrew, not deleted, still here so far.
And hopefully here to stay.
Hopefully.
So, over Christmas.
Darwin willing.
Up to you.
Oh yeah. It is largely up to me. That is... That's pretty funny.
Over Christmas, I received the gift of the official script book for The Batman, so that's what we're going over today on the podcast. So
your Christmas present led to this.
Yes. To be fair, I asked for it, so okay. It was kind of planned.
Mommy dearest, would you please?
Give me The Batman.
Give me The Batman original script book.
Not the movie, but the script book. Because the script book will be more in handy for our show.
That is true. Know what? I haven't even thought about getting this on Blu-ray yet. Man.
We're slipping. So used to HBO Max.
I know.
We're so used to the streaming now.
I know.
But if they're going to take things off of streaming now, then people have made that argument. Like, maybe it is time for us to go back to physical media a lot more.
Maybe they'll sell it to Netflix.
Nah, never. Anyways, they actually did release this script online shortly after I got this book, but whatever. It's cool to have it in your hand. It also comes with some of the pictures from the movie, so that's a cool addition. But I figured we would look into the differences between the film and the published script, including deleted scenes, moments that didn't make it in, even like small stuff that make it in. Yes, believe it or not, there are deleted scenes from this three-hour movie. So let's go.
It's short a lot, though, right? Real quick, from the top.
Yeah.
Did they cut all the good stuff out, or is like there's some stuff in here you wish was in it?
You know, I will let you judge that, but okay. I will say that this will not be something that is like Batman Forever, where you're just like, man, an entire subplot's gone. Like there's nothing really huge. It's just small, very small moments here and there. Plus a few scenes that the biggest one people already have seen. You know, it's the Joker one.
Yeah, the Joker one. That's I'm sure most people listening to this know about that part.
Yeah, so I'm not going to give you anything as big as the Joker moment in here, but it's still worth going over other things. So script is credited, of course, to Matt Reeves and Peter Craig with, it's not in the script book, but it is in the released online version, previous contributions by Mattson Tomlin, who we've mentioned before. Yes.
Actually, we do not know him.
We don't know him. We act as if we do, just because he seems so fun.
The thing is, Mattson Tomlin is about our age.
Yeah, that's
so
why.
it's like we kind of root for him because he's doing, you know, Batman scripts and shit, like actual legit Batman scripts. So
yeah, and the Imposter comic book series, which
I like. Yeah.
So he's not credited on the final film, likely due to WGA arbitration, but we do know he is currently working with Reeves on the script for the sequel, so he's here to stay.
They mentioned him specifically too, like they must have liked his contributions to the first one, and so they bring him on. You know, we liked your ideas, we're going to give you a bigger role in writing the next one. I don't know, we're just speculating, but that's the way it seems.
Yeah, Reeves has been there was like news articles on Reeves saying we are deep into writing the next one. I'm like, we needed news articles to tell us this.
They're just trying to give him something, man.
There's another one where it was just like the Penguin Show will connect to the Batman too. I was like, oh really? I thought it was going to be completely separate.
No, it's going to be a Penguin verse and then there'll be the Reeves verse and they might intersect. There's just gonna be like several, you know, four or five different verses at DC.
Penguin's got his own cinematic universe. It'll be Penguin No Way Home with him and Danny DeVito and
the Colin verse.
Yeah. So let's go into some of the deleted stuff. So one of the first things I noticed is in the voiceover in the beginning, there's some added lines that we do not hear Bruce say in the movie. He discusses how the criminal element is waiting to prey on the vulnerable. And he also talks about, you know, that he's got that line about 2 years of nights have turned me into a nocturnal animal.
Yeah.
And he carries over that metaphor feeling like his senses have now heightened. And he says, I can almost smell them in the element. So maybe they took that out because people might create some jokes on that. But
I feel like I'm developing echolocation.
Or he's got a bit of a Wolverine type of thing going on, too.
Oh, I could see them taking out the smell line for sure.
I sense something was up with this because this is actually in the young adult prequel novel Before the Batman by David Lumen. that we've discussed before on the Patreon. And the author was working off the script, but it has an epilogue that is essentially the opening of the Batman with the line, you know, I can almost smell them, like that part. Okay. That part. And I'm like, that's not in the movie, is what I remember when I got to that part in the book. So now I know why. It's in the original script.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, there are also some interesting costume differences in the script versus the movie. First off is the drophead, who is the guy who's basically holding up the convenience store. In the script, it says he's supposed to be wearing a sad emoji mask. So
they made an
interesting choice here where they decided to make it more of the, I guess, indicative of the drops drugs that are going around in the movie.
What's in the movie is a better choice. It being an emoji thing is just like too playing to the kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's too pandering. I like this drophead, although it is make me wonder, like, at first because you don't really know what drops are in the movie just yet, I feel like.
Yeah.
You're like, what is this? It's supposed to be like kind of a fucked up pumpkin or something. Like my mind was really trying to wrap my head around this character. But like I've said before, the first 15 minutes or so of this movie are probably my favorite part of the whole thing.
It's a solid opening.
Yeah, I think it's great. Part. Yeah.
This drophead also in the movie is caught in the spotlight of the helicopter, which makes him look up and notice the bat signal. In the script, we don't really have that moment. He instead goes outside and he sees other people looking up and he follows their gaze. So slightly different there. Another interesting costume change is that in the opening, there are also these vandals who are spray painting on the bank and stuff. And then they see the bat signal and they take off. In the movie, they're just wearing like regular like masks and face coverings and stuff. But in the script, it says that they're wearing Guy Fawkes masks, which would have been an interesting visual connection to V for Vendetta, but not really necessary.
I mean, there's no way that would have made it. It's kind of political with like
it's too anonymous associated.
Yeah, with anonymous and all that. It's just like, honestly, don't even know why they wrote it to begin with, because they know it's going to be taken out.
Yeah. Again, like I'm telling you, the stuff that got cut out, you're going to be like, well, nothing too huge.
Yeah,
Like what we got in the movie.
I like hearing this though, but yeah, I could just see. I mean, I loved V for Vendetta, dude. Thought it was a great movie, you know.
Yeah.
But in this political
different
climate,
association these days.
Yeah.
For sure. So one of the most famous trailer moments is in the introduction of Batman when he beats up the gang leader and says, "I'm vengeance." Great part, but the script was very different. In the script, the leader, like in the movie, says, "Who the hell are you supposed to be?" And Batman responds, "I'm vengeance," before he beats the guy up. So it would have shifted the dynamic more. I think they determined when they were shooting it, this plays out a lot better when he says it after he beats the ever-loving shit out of this guy in front of everyone.
Right.
So I think that was a good choice. There was also a line that was cut where one of the other gang members at the last minute recognizes it's Batman and says, "Holy shit, it's him," which is like, I think it's kind of maybe whispered a little bit, but like it's not as pronounced as in the script. So, I think
he has 2 years in, so it's not totally out of the question. Someone would say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the guy doesn't recognize him on site anyway, you know, in the movie or in the script, which is, as you said, makes sense. And plus it's Halloween. So you can see the misinterpretation that it's just some dude who's walking in with a Halloween costume.
Right.
Another interesting detail is the script identifies that Bruce is 30 years old in this, which means that he would have been 29 in year one. For comparison, in the year one comic, he was 25 turning 26. So he's a little bit older, but he's also still younger than Bale's Batman, who is 29 turning 30 in Batman Begins, since he has his birthday party and there's the number 30 in the background in Begins. So he's around similar age to Bale, still younger than Keaton, since Keaton in the script stuff is supposed to be 32 to 35 as a year one Batman, which these days sounds like it's much older than in the comic, but that's, you know, they tailored that to who was being cast at the time.
Okay.
So, another interesting detail, this is something that I think would have been interesting to basically add into it, which is that we were meant to see the padlock door to Thomas and Martha Wayne's room earlier in the movie as Bruce is changing in the hallway, just to establish that earlier. I would have liked that because it kind of is just sort of introduce to you much later in the movie, and then that's it. Like, they don't really do much with it outside of just the scene where you get introduced to it, he goes in, and then that's it.
Right.
So, I think this would have built it up a little bit more in terms of, like, what is that place? What, you know, why is it locked? All those sorts of aspects. Another thing that I thought was cool was in the description, it is noticed that Bruce is described as, quote, muscular, but underweight like a rock star. So,
okay,
it's very interesting because a lot of people have criticized Pattinson's physique, but this looks very deliberate where they didn't want him to be, you know, buffed out like John Cena. And we've talked about it several times on the pod before, but it's basically continuing Reeves's influence of Bruce as like a Kurt Cobain type. And I guess he wanted a similar type of physique for that. So what we got in the movie is deliberate for how Reeves envisions Bruce in his second year.
Right. Yeah. We don't need every one of the Batman to be a brick shithouse, you know, yeah. And it's fine. Mm-hmm. Batfleck was cool, but also this is just fine.
In the movie, Bruce talks with Alfred before the maid Dory announces that the Wayne executives have arrived. And then it kind of just cuts to the Batcave. In the script, there was supposed to be a scene. This is our first major deleted scene here. There was supposed to be a scene where he does meet with the Wayne executives and they show up and Bruce is distracted. He's wearing the sunglasses during the day that's coming through the windows, which is where this shot from the trailer comes from. The trailer is not in the movie. We do see him don the sunglasses, but we don't actually see him looking at the newspaper. Go ahead.
So about the sunglasses, my little tidbit, and I think you know this, Ben. Mm-hmm. You know, Mattson Tomlin, we see him on Twitter all the time.
Yeah.
And he's a huge Matrix fan. He's watching Matrix like all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think somebody tweeted at him like, this was your idea, wasn't it? And he just responded with like a, I don't know. He didn't confirm it, of course, but it was like a smiley emoji or something like that. You know, it's like he wanted Bruce to be wearing sunglasses.
Yeah.
Again, don't know for sure if that was Tomlin's idea, but maybe.
It's a cool idea that he's been out at night, so the sun makes him averse to even looking at it, so he has to wear that. So the Wayne executives visit, but Bruce is so distracted, he's not even paying attention to what they're talking about. He's looking at the newspaper, he's looking at the cipher, and thinking of the Riddler. And then the next scene is what we got in the movie, where he's talking to Alfred. I was hoping there'd be more to this, especially in dealing with, like, it's built up a little bit in the previous scene where Alfred is, you know, sort of yelling at Bruce that, like, I couldn't get you to come to them, so I'm bringing them over to you. And they don't really do much with that aspect. So that's probably why it was cut. You know, it serves the exact purpose that you would think, but there's nothing surprising, nothing super dramatic that happens in it.
Yeah, so ultimately cut like it was, like what happened.
I think that was a good call. The only reason why I missed it was, or felt like I was missing it in the movie, was because of the fact that we got this shot from the trailer that we didn't get to see in the movie, as well as, you know, some buildup of like, oh, the Wayne executives are here, and then we didn't actually see them. But now that we know the scene didn't lead anywhere, you can understand that.
It must have almost made it, because if it's in the trailer, it's like it might have been in the cut for a while, and then it was ultimately cut kind of near the end of the editing process.
You can also see in this is basically a shot below of the behind the scenes featurette off of somebody's TV. That's the closest I could get to this, but you can kind of see the continuation of the rock star influence. You got a bit of a guitar on the left.
You
got speakers.
They're doing that.
Yeah, you got all that there. So that would have been part of the scene too.
I could see him being buds with James Gunn too. Like, James Gunn always really infuses music really strongly with this stuff. Like, I don't know if you've started Peacemaker yet, Ben, but instead of like the mom rock and the dad rock of, well, it's all kind of dad rock at this point, I feel like, but they always called Guardians of the Galaxy stuff mom rock. But he's got, like, you know, for Peacemaker, it's like 80s glam metal kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's so strongly infused in it, and it makes it work. And like, I just really like how you can, they kind of combine, you know, he's had this, you know, the rock star thing was kind of really part of the DNA from the get go here.
Mm-hmm.
With the Kurt Cobain thing was not an afterthought. It's like, seems like it was really like from the outset.
Yeah. That was his take for Bruce Wayne from the beginning.
Yeah. Such an interesting take. Like, no one ever really thought about that. Hopefully Bruce doesn't kill himself with a fucking shotgun, but no,
I don't think that part is going to be part of it, but something in the way is identified in the script.
Oh,
it
really?
Does say okay. It comes on the soundtrack. It is deliberate.
Damn. That's cool. Yeah. So great. I know that, they were like playing Layla from, Clapton or whatever it is. Man,
for Goodfellas.
Yeah, during Goodfellas, like during the filming of certain sequences or something, and probably a lot more of that. I just love the combination of like music and rock, especially kind of influencing directors and writers and stuff.
Yeah, that's definitely here.
Yeah.
The next cut scene is after the Batcave scene where Bruce tells Alfred to, you know, take away certain things, and it leaves the clue drive. So once he figures that out, we have the cut scene where he contacts Gordon, who's at the GCPD bullpen at this. So there's some other images from behind the scenes featurettes of sort of Gordon in the bullpen with the rest of the cops here. And this is from that cut scene. We even covered some of the concept art of that scene in our concept art episode for the Batman. So we've kind of known something like this was coming, but essentially Batman calls Gordon asking about like Mitchell's car, which kind of goes back to what you brought up before on the show of just like they didn't check the car already.
Dude, it's a major suspect. It feels like it's just a no brainer. Yeah. Like you're going to check the car, you know, whatever. It's
the
fine.
Entire area. Yeah.
But like the guy, I assume like the lead suspect, you're going to check, if you know that he has a car, you're going to check where that fucking car is, man. Like, I don't know. That's one thing that kind of stood out to me in this movie, but it didn't ruin it or anything, but it was just like, I don't know, a little off.
So in the scene, they basically are looking at the cipher and they think the feds will take a week to crack. But of course, it's taken Bruce that morning along with Alfred. But Bruce calls Gordon asking about Mitchell's car, and when Gordon sees the other cops are wondering who Gordon's talking to, he lies to them saying, quote, "It's my daughter, Barbara." So
been
a little bit of an Easter egg, a hint at the future Batgirl and Oracle. And like I've said before in the Patreon, if Warner Brothers wants to repair some good publicity after the Batgirl cancellation, Leslie Grace is age appropriate to pass off as Jeffrey Wright's daughter. It would be a completely different type of Batgirl, but we'll have to see.
Dude. Her final suit also, I mean, her first suit too was cool, but all these leaked, the leaked images of her, her final suit too was like perfect. It sucks. That part sucks of this whole, you know, rebranding and everything, but everything else I like, but Batgirl going, I don't like.
She could easily, you know, be Barbara in this version, though, of course, we obviously aren't going to see the Batgirl movie to know what the tone and the world was like, but it would have to be obviously a different take on this things to adapt to it. But
they're talking about, people talking about a leak. What are you talking about? Like half a film put together? Like that movie was barely edited, I assume. There's no film to leak.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm going off on a tangent here.
If there is, it's a very, very rough cut.
It's got to be extremely rough. Temp tracks, dissolves that don't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a film yet, more than likely. And it, sadly, probably will never be. But anyway, her suit was awesome. Both of her suits.
Yeah. I agree. It basically looks like the comics.
Yes, perfect. It was
purple.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's all there.
Yeah.
An improvement over what we got in Batman and Robin.
She was the best part of that one, though.
That's true. All right. Another deleted moment happens at the Iceberg Lounge when Batman arrives to question Penguin. There's a beat, not in the movie, where Penguin tries to feel up Selina's thigh and she threatens to break his fingers. I was like, oh, okay, that's new. In the final film, there's not really much interaction between Penguin and Selina at all, but there's more here in the script with little moments like this. That was interesting. That was a surprise when I got to that. And another thing to note is that even though Matt Reeves and company are on record that Selina is not Catwoman yet in this movie, she's called Catwoman in the script. So,
Okay.
I'm not sure. Also, just a note on that, like they've been saying that, but I'm not sure what else Selina needs to do in order to become Catwoman. Like Penguin
needs a full-on suit. Really, that's all there is at this point.
She just needs a more cat-like mask, which she could have had in this movie. It's like in the comics, she gets inspired by Batman's getup to become, you know, to take on the cat motif. But Batman's been around for over a year at this point, so it's not like it would have been that out of the question to get a cow in this one. So I'm curious, like, what if there's some other part of the development that we're due to see to lead into that. Penguin, look, I can kind of understand a little bit because he doesn't have some of the same, like, he's on the rise, right? He's not a big time mobster yet. He doesn't have the moniker or the umbrella. We don't even know if that's going to happen, but it's a little bit more on the rise. Catwoman, I'm like, she's pretty much Catwoman in this. She's Catwoman in the script. We'll see.
In this script, where do you think, like, as is, where do you think they could have debuted a Catwoman suit?
I mean, I think she could have just been Catwoman.
I know.
When she shows up. Do you mean, okay, so you mean,
yeah. Just she's already in the suit. Yeah.
So short of that, you mean, though? Like, short of.
Yeah,
that,
yeah. If it's not that, then when does she evolve into it? Because the ending is so, like, it gets heavy, right? It gets pretty heavy with her story. So if she's like, if shit's getting heavy with her and she's like, hey, I'm a cat now, you know, it's like a little bit, a little bit off. Maybe after that heaviness.
Maybe at the very end when she's about to leave Bloodhaven. Like, that's the only way I can think of where, like, the movie has kind of led to her evolution to become Catwoman at the end, and she's let go of wanting revenge on Falcone, and then at the end she's wearing a cat mask. Like, it's tough to fit it in. Like, that's also why I'm saying she should just be Catwoman from the beginning. Just have her with a cowl when she shows up at the mayor's place, because otherwise, like, what? She goes through this whole story that has nothing to do with a cat motif just so that she can get a cat cowl at the end.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Just have it from the get-go. We're coming in 2 years in anyway. Who cares?
Yeah. Like, if this was year one and, like, this is his, like, second night out, it's kind of understandable that she wouldn't think of a cat motif yet. But she's been around for a little over a year at this point, so it stands to reason. So we could have had it. That's also why I'm curious, like, well, what more is there for her to become more of a cat?
I know. What people get so lost in the weeds of, like, the origin story sometimes, and it's just like, we don't really need all that every time. It's like,
she needs a mask, she needs a proper cat cowl, and she needs that chain to be a whip. That's pretty much where we're at. That's all we need.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
We don't need that much more. But we're all leading up towards the major deleted scene that, if you're a fan of this movie and listening to this podcast, as Andrew mentioned, you probably have already seen it on YouTube or on HBO Max, because the cool thing is HBO Max makes it available as sort of a, like, featurette thing.
Oh, nice.
When you click on the bat. So if you don't know, shortly after the murder of Commissioner Savage, Batman visits Arkham Asylum and asks the Joker for his thoughts on Riddler. So Joker would have shown up earlier in the movie. And this is very much a scene in the spirit of the Thomas Harris novel Red Dragon, the movie Manhunter, both of which were the introduction of Hannibal Lecter. So for those who don't know that much about Hannibal, in that story of Red Dragon / Manhunter, Will Graham is an FBI agent who caught Hannibal years ago and is hunting a new serial killer. And he decides to, you know, in order to get into this guy's head and get the scent again, as it said in the story, he decides to visit the last killer he caught, Hannibal Lecter. And that sort of establishes the whole Hannibal Lecter trope of, you know, in order to catch a new killer, you have to, you know, you have to think like one and talk to the other one. And I'm sure some of that was also inspired by all the John Douglas Mindhunter stuff, too, in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But in that scene, Hannibal ends up turning the tables on Will and brings up how much he and Will are like, playing around with the whole idea of Will kind of being close to becoming a serial killer himself in terms of his own mental issues. So that's kind of the scene in that story. This deleted scene is very similar. Batman, searching for insight into how the Riddler thinks, goes to the previous killer he caught, the Joker, or as Reeves says, also the man who will call himself the Joker at one point. Again, I don't know what else he needs to be the Joker. He's got green hair and the white face and the red lips, but at this point, we'll just call him the Joker. And Joker turns the tables and indicates how similar Batman and the Riddler are. Bringing up that Batman secretly thinks that all these people who have been killed so far, the mayor and the commissioner and the future corrupt officials, that they all deserve to die. So this is an interesting scene. I feel like the response to this was kind of lukewarm when it was released. Am I Am I wrong in feeling that way in terms of just the overall fan, not my personal feelings, just like the overall fan response to this?
I think you're not wrong. And I think it's like, we don't get a lot. He didn't do much evil shit. We see him laugh in a room. You know, it's like, his, honestly, this is subjective, I guess, but like his look isn't great. I mean, I just, I'm personally not a fan of this look for Joker. I'm not,
it's my least favorite. It's my least favorite design, dude.
And I haven't found anyone that really loves this design. I'm sure we'll get some comments about it, but like, that's fine.
Probably agree with
we
us.
We can agree to disagree if you love this design, but personally, I don't love it. And I think I'd like to think a lot of people didn't. It seems like a lot of people didn't, and they just didn't respond to it. And yeah, I mean, he just doesn't do much either. He's not in the Joker suit. And
he's just the Hannibal Lecter of the scene.
We haven't just had Joker. It was in 2008, but still doesn't, I don't know, maybe people my age at least, it doesn't feel too long ago at the same time.
Well, I mean, you had what it was like Suicide Squad 2016, Joaquin 2019, Snyder Cut 2021. Yeah. So
we had like four Jokers in between Ledger, right? Yeah, like you said.
Yeah, and also then, counting and then, Cameron Monaghan on Gotham. So yeah, like we've had like, a ton.
So yeah, I guess that's part of my point, is that it's not special. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think they should not do Joker for the Batman 2. They should save the Joker.
Yeah.
Hopefully not, because save him for the third one, because usually, as we saw with Dark Knight Rises, like a lot of the times the third movie fails. Like in a trilogy, Godfather 3, Terminator 3, there's a lot of examples of this, right? Mm-hmm. So if you save, you know, the big guy for the third one, I think you kind of curtail, you kind of, you know, make that a little, you have a better chance of that third one being more crackerjack. You know what I mean?
It could be interesting if they do continue this Hannibal thing, you know, because Hannibal Lecter, the, not counting the fucking prequel Hannibal Rising, because everyone hates that, but like his main appearances are Red Dragon, where he has a very small role, kind of like what we got of this. And then Silence of the Lambs is like, he's got a bigger role. That's like, that's what really put Hannibal on the map with Anthony Hopkins and shit. And then at the end of Silence of the Lambs, spoilers for an over 30-year-old movie, but he escapes. And then it's Hannibal, where he is the main villain. Like, that's the structure of the Hannibal leading up to it. There wasn't really much else to go from there after that Hannibal book. So Harris went back and did the prequel, but you can see where I'm going with that. Like, that could be the structure that you're talking about, where he has a little bit more of a Hannibal Lecter type role in the second one, or in this, you know, this upcoming Arkham show on HBO Max. And then he escapes at the end of the second one. And then the third one is him with Riddler and whoever else is introduced and all that type of stuff.
I think so. I think it's a way to make that, to kind of take away the curse of the third movie in a trilogy. You know, despite now, however he looks or whatever, being a Batman versus Joker thing, like, that's the most classic lineup, right? And just making the third one's the best. The second one's just like Dark Knight. It's just like, I just don't think it's a good move. It's copying too much. I know the second one in the trilogy is like Empire is supposed to be the darkest or whatever, and maybe you want your Joker film to be the darkest, but this trilogy is already dark as fuck, so I think it's probably just going to be the same level of darkness maybe throughout. I mean how much darker can they get? Especially in PG-13.
They shouldn't. Like, I don't think they'll do it for the second one, because if they're writing it now, likely they're going to start pre-production sometime later this year in 2023, aim for a 2025 release date. But what happens in 2024? Joker 2 with Joaquin. You're really going to just follow Joaquin immediately with another Joker thing? I don't think that's likely.
Not good timing. So we're listing like a billion reasons why not to do Joker in the second one.
Yeah. And I think the overall response to not just the deleted scene, but the scene in the movie was just like, Joker again. And like, I get it. But also, like, I've brought this up every single time. Like, if you're Matt Reeves and you finally got the keys to the Batman kingdom, are you really going to skip the Joker? You're just not going to have the Joker at all. You're never going to do that character.
I mean, A, would be ballsy if they never did. If we had a Batman trilogy with no Joker, I'd kind of respect that. But I do understand that you kind of need him at the same time. Eventually, I'm just saying, save him for the third one.
Yeah.
Save him for the third one. That's it.
I think there's also speculation that maybe they deleted it so that they can have the opportunity to redo the design on this one, which I'm like, that might be wishful thinking considering that they did release it. And you do kind of get a glimpse that he still looks fucked up in the final movie. Yeah, he looks the same in the movie. But like, I think like when we first saw it, right, with that scene at the end where he's talking to Riddler, like you could only see a little bit. You knew he was kind of fucked up, but you couldn't really see that much. Right. So it was there. And then now that we've seen a little bit of a closer look, with a lot more stuff going on, it kind of fills in the blanks once we get to that scene again when we rewatch the end there. So it's, I think it's because we've seen this deleted scene that fills it in. But, you know, let's say if they go for a cleaner look on Barry Keoghan for, you know, when Joker shows up again in Arkham or the other stuff, I mean, it's mainly going to be us who notice. It's really going to be the hardcore fans, but the general public who might vaguely remember that there was a Joker tease at the end of the Batman aren't going to be like, "Wait, that's inconsistent with the continuity." They're just going to be say that that's cool.
No, okay. So I thought about this too. Mm-hmm. You have a guy that has his whole deal being with acid on the face and chemicals on the face and shit like that. So I don't know if they have to explain it or not, but if they really feel like they have to, something to do with the acid on the face or whatever, he re-dips himself again and acts as chemicals or something, and then he has like a real clean look. I don't know, but I'm just I was just trying to think of a way they could do it I feel like no one liked that makeup, dude.
Yeah, they went too far. Like I've never been a fan of disfigured Joker. I mean, I didn't like it with Ledger, really. I didn't like it when they did it to Cameron Monaghan on Gotham. I didn't like it in the comics when Joker just carved his face off.
That was so edgelord shit.
I'm pretty consistent with this. I'm like, he doesn't need it. He doesn't need it. I get that they're trying to do the whole like, well, if he was burned by chemicals, then this is what chemical burns would look like. I'm like, okay, I get that, but like he's got patches of hair. Like this dude is balding on this. It's repulsive to look at. And even though like, yeah, this is a little bit more of an adult Batman oriented thing, there's still going to be kids in the audience. You know,
I just felt like, man, again, we're jackasses on the internet. Mm-hmm. What do our opinions matter to Matt Reeves and everybody involved? But it's just, I feel like it was his worst decision out of the whole movie.
Was including Joker at the end?
No, not his inclusion. Was his design. Joker's makeup is Reeves' single worst decision by Reeves for this particular film.
Yeah, so it is hard to hold it against him when the scene is not in the movie. You know, like we
that's
only get
well, that is true. Moves. Wait, so there's no, I forgot, I'm forgetting. So there's no Joker at all? They do show
there
him,
there is
right?
Joker, they do show him, but like it's such a like small glimpse. You could barely make it out. Like,
you don't even see the makeup.
Smile. You see the smile a little bit, but it's like, it's very, it's hard to tell.
Oh yeah. Know, like, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So
it could be redone.
He kind of saves himself, I guess. So in my eyes, at least. So yeah, I think maybe he even had like, what do you call it? Cold feet or whatever about it as well. And you know, or maybe that probably ultimately that scene just didn't fit in the beginning of the movie, but I don't know. Yeah. I guess, yeah, he has the wiggle room now to fix that. Basically. But what we did see in the release scene that was deleted, it was just not good. Not good.
No. I'll take the tattooed version over this one. Just in terms of design.
Dude, what's worse?
Not necessarily the performance, just purely talking about design. Because at least with Leto and Suicide Squad, even if you take out the damage shit and the grill, it's still like a clean look. It's still like the slicked back green hair, the like gaunt face, the white, like it's still somewhat the Joker in there.
Yeah.
There's some bullshit mixed in, but there's still somewhat the Joker. But this is like, when you look at it, you can, you can tell, but it's such a, again, it's edgelord shit is what it feels like. It's on this just, take, and it's just not my thing.
Just quite disfigured. I mean, like the Joker is like, I don't know how much parallels you should have to Satan and Lucifer, but like Lucifer is supposed to be real beautiful, right? Like, not that Joker is supposed to be vain, but I don't know. It's just something about, yeah, I think the clean look would work better.
One of the best things about Phoenix and the role was the fact that it was just makeup. It was right. Just literal clown face paint, and the rest was just all the performance, you know. And
that was a good one.
That's what I want for the next joke, because like I don't think we're gonna ever see Joaquin fight a Batman in those movies.
No,
so
we're
like we need to see some version of that. And but yeah, the list of guys who have mainly just been face paint and stuff is basically Cesar Romero, Joaquin Phoenix, and then like 80% Nicholson if you don't count the prosthetic on his cheek. You know,
right?
Everyone else has had some sort of like prosthetic type stuff on their face for disfigurement, and it's just, I'm tired of it. Like, I just have like some of the Joker cosplayers that you see or out there, you're just like, dude, like, why doesn't he look like that in the movies? You know,
that is true. Yeah, I don't know why they think it'll look too comic booky, maybe, but like we've said before, you can have them have that look, but this exact tone, just mix those two together. Yeah, you know, you could have a blue and black, yellow Batman suit, but steal this tone.
Yeah.
Steal this exact fucking Zodiac killer tone.
You can still do, like, I think some people have brought up how, like, or defended some of the things that we might have bashed in the past design-wise of being like, well, Batman would, like, he would prioritize things that would be, you know, useful, would be utilitarian and stuff. I'm like, why can't it be useful and look good at the same time? Like, why is it that it shouldn't look like the comics just because it doesn't look useful? I'm like, it's, of course it's useful. Otherwise he wouldn't be using it. Just make it look more like the comic.
You can get really bogged down in trying to always figure out what would work in the real world, because ultimately this is fantasy. So it's just kind of where you draw the line of where fantasy and reality are split. Mm-hmm. And that's where the subjective part comes in, and where, you know, the director ultimately, and the writer draws that line. I mean, yeah. You know, it's a guy in a bat suit with his fucking chin hanging out, you know, like it's fucking not, you know, it's not real. It's nothing real about it, you know? So like, why stop there? Why not also make the suit cooler looking? You know what I mean? It's a fucking Joker guy. Sometimes it does feel like, because comics are so popular, that some like real bad guys in real life will mimic this stuff sometimes, which is that's life mimicking art, but that's gonna become like the snake eating itself, I guess, at a certain point. But anyway, that's another fucking topic. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you're talking about like things being practical or not. I mean, also, like in the case of the Batman suit, like dark blue is like actually blends in with night more also, right? Don't they say? So like even with that, it's like it still sort of could make sense.
You know what a great example was that I was told recently? Look at the ocean at night on the beach.
Oh yeah.
Does that look like really bright blue to you?
Yeah, you exactly.
Like, exactly. Like, ah, that's a good point. I mean, they said you can make arguments on how blue the water is depending on where you live, but still,
right?
It's a good point.
Dark black is a silhouette. You could just kind of see that easily even at night. So, you know, it's interesting how like that some of these really comic book ideas could still work if you want to think about it in very realistic terms, you know.
Well, I think also because the writers behind these comics these days have grown up with this stuff and have already asked these questions. Like, you don't need to become a film director to think about like, okay, why is this happening? Like, you can still write the comic and be like, well, you know, add in a fucking dialogue bubble about like blue is, you know, he dons blue because of this reason, or a dialogue bubble about why there's a yellow oval on the chest, which is what Frank Miller did in explaining it's a target, you know. Like, it's he did that back in 1986.
It's kind of cool. Yeah. If you give them, I love that. I mean, if you give the enemy a target, you always know where they're going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's awesome.
And it's practical and it looks good and comic accurate.
So yeah.
It's not that tough.
Yeah. I would like to think, I hope that there's Warner people listening to this. And again, ultimate point, like Ben and I are saying, get more comic booky looking suits. You can have your cake and eat it too. More comic booky looking suits, but still dark ass tone like this movie. Don't change a thing about the tone, Matt Reeves.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So with that, we have, as we've discussed, the Joker scene. And after that, let us know in the comments what you thought about this scene when you saw it. And we'll resume talk about the script after the break.
Just wanted to announce that I have a new podcast called Gaming Gaiden. It's about Japanese to English translation. In this first season, it will be 10 episodes each season. If you saw the ranking, every Superman video game two-parter we did here on Superhero Stuff You Should Know, you have seen Mike before. So yes, if you like video games, if you've been interested in Japanese ever, we're going to be talking a lot about just Japan in general, Japanese cultural differences as well, and we also are going to have a lot of talk about 90s video game magazines such as Electronic Gaming Monthly, aka EGM. So stay tuned for Gaming Gaiden Podcast. It's already out now, y'all. I want to tell you about the Patreon.com. Patreon.com/SuperheroStuffPod. And on that, you get the $1 tier. You can join the $1 tier, which gets you the shout out on the board and either visually or aurally or both at times. we want to do the aural for the most part for newer people. And then the $5 tier gets you a whole new show. This show is every Monday, as you well know, and it's free on YouTube and the What's Nots. And Patreon show is every Friday at the $5 tier mark. You can, if you want, binge us for $5. And there's like 150 episodes, almost 150 at this point. And you can, listen to all that content there. Even the stuff that's been released from the vault, none of that has been the full episode as well. So trying to keep our $5 tier people happy. So, check that out. And then our $10 tier gets you all of the above, plus it gets you a monthly meetup show where you meet up with us monthly, and it's like a Zoom-like call, and we have a topic at hand, or sometimes videos we react to and things like that. And that's at the $10 tier. Every tier that you get, like the $5 tier, gets you the $1 tier benefits, and the $10 tier gets you the $5 tier benefits and the $1 tier benefits. So check that out at patreon.com/superherostuffpod. We also got the merch, which is Redbubble, superhousepod.redbubble.com, and on Threadless, superherostuffpod.threadless.com. Get your Bin Man and Indeed Wizard mug, shirt, shower curtains, and all the rest artwork by Stefan Santa Cruz. And please send us some audio at superhousepodcast@gmail.com. A bumper would be great. Mm-hmm. You too can be part of the show. I'm Thunderwolf Drew on Instagram and Twitter. Thunderwolf Lives as my other YouTube channel, one of my many YouTube channels. And I have also ThunderwolfDrew.com has my whole portfolio in one place except for AmanoRecon.com. That's AmanoRecon.com. And that is an original idea that some friends and I are doing where it is R-rated Power Rangers meets Stranger Things. That's the quick pitch, and it is not a fan film, original idea. We have a pitch video right now on YouTube and on the Indiegogo page. We're campaigning right now as of this, when this episode premieres. And this poster art is by ZacharyJacksonBrownArt.com. And check it out. Please support us on the campaign. And more from that soon. But yes, it's bloody. And if you like that kind of thing, check us out. And that's it, Ben.
Follow us on social media, on Twitter at SuperHousePod, Instagram Superhero Stuff Pod, where we have some different supplemental stuff. I've even analyzed the martial arts stance that the Keaton ornament from The Flash is in, so you can check that out on our Instagram, Superhero Stuff Pod, TikTok, Superhero Stuff Pod, Vero, Superhero Stuff Pod. My website is benjuanrider.com, where you can read a whole bunch of spec scripts, including Gotham, Vampire, Elementary, The Death of Sherlock Holmes, and Curb Your Enthusiasm, Disneyland. If you're fans of any of those shows, check them out and let us know what you think. My YouTube channel is in the description below, including Doctor Who, The Ronin of Time, an audio drama I write, edit, and narrate with the Eighth Doctor, meeting Miyamoto Musashi. My personal Instagram is benjuanrider. If you like cats, my son, Alfie, my cat, is at Alfie Pennyworth Cat. And if you have an Alfie yourself, then you can get the Whisker Box, the only cat box with a crazy cat lady and gent. And you can even check out another page on that website, superherostuffpod.com/show notes, that includes various show notes for each of our episodes, links to the scripts that we review if they're available online, Amazon links to the stuff we've been talking about, including, you know, Brian Levant's book that he plugged for us, My Life and Toys. So check that out at superherostuffpod.com/show notes.
Lord have mercy, y'all. Do you like hounds? Do you enjoy pooches? Do you find yourself enjoying time spent with that of canines? Talking about dogs, y'all.
As you might have heard, Superhero Stuff You Should Know has now teamed up with BarkBox. For every month, you get a box for your special canine.
Pooches.
Or hounds.
That's right. One free extra month if you go to BarkBox.com/SuperheroStuffPod.
Follow the link and you'll get a free extra month valued at $35 and valid for all multi-length plans.
So get the BarkBox for your hound, for your pooch, for your canine.
Your doggo will thank you.
Well, back in 1972, ding-dong, ding-dong, ding-da-ding.
We're back. The Batman returned, and we're going to cover the rest of the script and all the new stuff that's in it. So, they released the Joker deleted scene, as we talked about, but they also released another deleted scene that I don't know that you and I have talked about yet on the show.
Okay.
This is with Selina and the Penguin. So, as I said, the script has a lot more of the two of them together. Not like a whole subplot and stuff, but just more between the two of them. But this was released. It takes place when Batman sends Selina into the Iceberg Lounge with the contacts on. And there's this additional scene where she goes to Oz to ask him if she can work at basically the, you know, 44 below. Penguin shows concern towards her in getting hurt there because he knows that some of the worst people are down there. And he tells her, you know, he wants to look out for her. Even talks about how he, how she knows how he feels about her. So we kind of got Penguin following in the footsteps of DeVito in wanting to be with Selina, though that was a little bit more of him just being a perv in returns. But he also indicates that he has plans to rise up in Gotham and that one day the city is going to be his. So,
hell yeah.
Some foreshadowing of the Penguin HBO Max show as well as the end. But also, I think somebody brought this up. It shows the Batman Penguin's ambitions and could explain why Batman suspects Penguin first as being Ra's al Ghul. So,
okay,
that could be an additional thing. But it's just, it's mainly just another Penguin scene, a showcase for him. Doesn't really tell us that much more than what we would already have assumed, which is that he has ambitions in this. So it's not completely, again, this is not one of those things where I'm like, man, they shouldn't have cut it. I'm like, it's a nice character moment, but that's about it.
Right.
Some of the things I noticed that are not in the script. So some things that I'll note are not in the script, but are in the movie. But there's the part in the movie where Batman sees through Selina's eyes the corrupt cop, William Kenzie, and he brings up, oh, I must have broke his nose. That is not in the script. And I suspect that is ADR put in later
on. Oh, probably, yeah.
It's voiceover anyway in the movie. Yeah. So that's an easy thing to ADR without really screwing anything up.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's they found that in ADR.
Yeah, it's probably because they might have done a test run and test like screening and some exec was just like, wait, where does that guy come from? And why, you should highlight him more. And they're like, okay, fine. We'll just have, you know, Bruce say something earlier. And then they did the ADR line for that. So that's an interesting thing that I picked up when reading it, that this whole part where he talks to her is cut before she goes into the elevator and talks to him. So that was cool. Another thing as well that is kind of hinted at in the movie, but is very clear in the script, is that the Batmobile is under construction in the background in the Batcave. You can kind of tell based off of where it is, but it's sort of flat out said. in the script. So I really like that aspect of it. You can also see the tarp around it. Like, it's definitely kind of in progress, but because there's not like just like shot of only the Batmobile in it, it's sort of, it can be easy to miss if you're watching it.
It's cool though. Great shot. Yeah, love that.
There is a small cut line from Alfred too, after giving Bruce the Wayne cufflinks, because it ends in the movie where he's just like, your father gave them to me. And then it just cuts to Bruce driving to the funeral. In the scene, Alfred adds a little bit more levity to it by telling him, I'm just loaning it to you. You got to give this back to me afterwards. So it's kind of a nice, again, moment of levity, especially in this movie.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Again, like, it's not super needed in that, you know, like, I'm like, okay, yeah. it's not like the big button they needed for the end of the scene. The button for those wondering what I mean by that, I'm not really making a pun off of the cufflink thing, but more of like, button is sometimes what they say about like a great end to a scene, you know? So if somebody has like a great line and it cuts the next scene, like, that's the button to that scene. So that's what I mean by that.
It buttons it up.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
The script also has a deleted scene I suspected when we did the concept art episode, where we showed this shot of Bruce looking in the backseat of his car and there's the cowl. And I brought up how I would not envy Bruce of having to change out of his funeral suit into a bat suit in that cramped of a car. It's a great looking car. I just wouldn't want to change into a bat suit in that thing. Turns out I was wrong. So what actually happens in the script is that he goes to the car to retrieve the duffel bag, and then he goes off as everyone's running to go to a different place to change. I don't know where, some random alley where he's going to strip down and be naked and go into the bat suit. But he doesn't change in the car, which, I don't know, it seems like it would make more sense for him to change in the car. But if it's that car, I can kind of see why he doesn't.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that's also where this picture comes from of Pattinson walking around with a duffel bag, which is also in the poster. The poster that has all the different characters on it in the foreground is Pattinson carrying the duffel bag, but that's not in the movie.
Okay.
So that's one other instance of a very small moment where I'm like, eh, did we really need it anyway? It's only jarring, or we only miss it if you're just a hardcore fan like us, or just like, wait, there's this one promo picture in this poster that has him with a bag. Why doesn't he have it in the movie? Like, no one else noticed. No one else gives a shit. Okay, so here's a big piece of trivia that I wanted to share that when I was reading this, I was struck by an irony. So one of the moments that is in here that people have talked about is the glider scene where Batman eats shit when it gets to the bridge. It's, you know, meant to show that this Batman is still learning. It's very much inspired by Batman Earth 1, where his grappling gun doesn't work. But weirdly, the script does not say that Batman crashes at all. It says,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it says descending rapidly, dangerously to the street below, where Batman hits into a hard shoulder roll, spinning wildly to his feet and disappearing into the night, which kind of sounds like Batman Returns, where Keaton landed with a glider, then kind of rolled and then stood back up and then went to the Batmobile as if it was nothing.
This is such a big sequence though, that involves VFX and stunts and everything. So this is not a day of script rewrite.
No.
So this is just whatever script is in this book is just not the most updated one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's something they must have come up with before. I mean, obviously before shooting, but at some point there was a decision to have it so that he crashes. And this is interesting because, to make this even more weird, 30 years earlier, the shooting script for Batman Returns has Batman crash while using the glider, as shown in the comic book adaptation. But in the movie, it was a smooth landing with a rolling that is kind of like what's described in the Batman script. So we got this weird reversal where 30 years ago, Batman Returns writes that Batman crashes his glider, but the movie ends with him having a smooth landing. And then the Batman writes that he has a smooth landing, and then they decide, fulfilling a scene 30 years in the making, that he's going to crash the glider.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's added stunts, it's added everything. So, like, I could see them cutting something like that for Batman Returns if they really don't have the budget, if they want to put their budget somewhere else. But with this one, they really wanted to focus on his, you know, being green. So Yeah, I can, you know, it's interesting. Yeah.
It is interesting. Honestly, between the two, I think it would have worked better in Returns because he's already, like, emotionally, he's been framed. He's been shot by the cops. Catwoman right. has stabbed him with a talon.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
And he goes just immediately into this glider and he just crashes through trying to get away. Whereas in the Batman, like, yeah, he got blown up in the thing and protected himself, but he's had some time to recover because right afterwards he tries to fight cops, punches Gordon, runs all the way around, grapples up to the top. So if anyone's in a condition to crash, it's probably more Keaton in Returns than Pattinson in this moment in the Batman. And as we've talked about before in the concept art episode, like, it seems like they're trying to plant, like, hey, he's going to learn from this, but they never really pay off what he learns from it. You know, like, if he had yeah. the traditional glider at the end that we pitched, like, that yeah. would have shown, oh, he's progressing. But they don't really have that. We got to wait, you know, until 2025 to see if he improves it.
It feels like forever, dude.
I know. Some of the stuff you got to pay off in the movie. You got to pay yeah, off in yeah. the movie. Otherwise, I'm like, what is... Because I like the scene just because it's different. But then I'm like, well, was there much of a point in him crashing? Thematically?
Not thematically, but it's just showing yeah. that he's 2 years in and he probably hasn't practiced this particular thing too much. You know, like, this is not something... He probably trained jujitsu and shit a lot more mm-hmm. than this, you know, squirrel suit.
Yeah, I get that. It's just, I think, I mean, I do appreciate the aspect that this is a Batman who is a lot more rough around the edges than what we've seen before. You know,
yeah, like, yeah.
Bale takes out Falcone in one night in Batman Begins through a lot of, like, plot stuff. You know, Falcone just happens to be at the docks, but, like, it's, a lot of that's just because Falcone's not the main character. He's not the main villain of that movie. You need to get that villain out of the way. Yeah, so I yeah. get that. Whereas, like, in the comics and in Pattinson's version, like, it takes 2 years to take down Falcone in yeah. this universe and in the comics. Like, it's not like a simple, like, yeah, let me take down the biggest mob boss in one night. He's a lot less refined in that. Right. So I think audiences who criticize Pattinson, I'm starting to understand why when the previous thing is Begins, where he is in week or day one of being Batman and he can already use the glider fine. Whereas, like, year two Batman in this universe, he might not have used it ever beforehand, and he's going through more growing pains than what we saw in a week one Batman in Begins. But again, that's a completely different interpretation. You know, like, in that specific yeah. version from Bale, like, he's supposed to be, he practically just already is the goddamn Batman once he puts on the suit and Begins.
Yeah, whereas right.
Here, there's more of an evolution of that version of Batman, and I think there's upsides and downsides to it, but that's one of the things I actually like about this movie is that he's not completely refined yet. He's supposed to be learning from that. I just wish that there was a little bit more of the learning curve from the skills perspective shown. We've already seen it from, like, the thematic, like, hope perspective in the movie, or him gaining more heroism and compassion. But it you know, we have these scenes with him crashing and stuff where it doesn't really pay off much. It's kind of there. It's kind of there to just show that he's less refined, but I just kind of wish it played a little bit more of a role to the overall thing.
Right.
outside of that, we have the, again, it's interesting to see what's not in the script. So in the car chase with Penguin, there's a whole bunch of lines from Colin Farrell as Penguin that are not in the script. In fact, Penguin's only line in this whole sequence is Jesus Christmas during the chase.
So, my God, Reeves is just like, ah, we'll have him, improv some lines on the day. That's really,
that might have been what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, even I like the part where, especially because it shows how formidable Penguin can be when he's got the machine gun and he's like, hey, vengeance. And he's like shooting at him and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that's not in the script. That's not in the script. Okay. I don't know if that's just Colin Farrell just going ham on set, but that's not in the script.
Oh, dude, Colin Farrell's fucking improvising the shit out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and of course, the I got you, like, that part's in there where, like, he sees the explosion and he thinks he's taking him out. Like, that line's in there. But Penguin doesn't really have a line in this script in this entire sequence until Jesus Christmas during the chase and then the explosion.
And he didn't even say that, right? That line.
Yeah, he doesn't even say it in the movie. He says better dialogue in the movie. The this guy's crazy line in the trailer, that's not in the script. So again, it's interesting to take a look and see the differences here.
That's awesome. Colin Farrell, man, what a stellar job.
Yeah. Yeah, and he got the award as well for Banshees recently and stuff, which I got to check out. Again, another...
I do have to see that.
Another thing with him and Barry Keoghan together.
That is right. That is right.
It's hilarious because I don't know if you saw the... I think it was the Golden Globe speech where he takes the time to call out Barry Keoghan for eating his crunchy nut cereal and having him not... basically starving him from not being able to eat breakfast the next morning and stuff. I'm like, okay, this is the Penguin Joker feud in this moment.
That's awesome.
So that was funny. Also, putting that out there, the script confirms the Batmobile does not crash into anything that causes the explosion. It's trying to avoid the explosion that's already being caused. So that is in the script as well. Another deleted moment. We saw a hint of this in the DC Fandom featurette, which I'm showing here, where a shirtless Bruce knocks over a cabinet of files because he's so pissed off. What is actually happening here? So, as you can tell, this is probably from the sequence where he's shirtless and he's going through all the different clues about the renewal fund. And this was supposed to pay off in a scene where he just gets so pissed off about finding nothing that he destroys the file cabinet. But in the process, he finds the Wayne cufflink that Alfred gave him. And it's a reminder about Alfred being hurt and in the hospital. And the action lines say, quote, "If Bruce would ever allow himself to cry, it would be now." So it does have an emotional button to that, but I think it already kind of fulfills that aspect in the previous scenes. You know, Alfred's already hurt. There's the, like, I think a much better way to sum that up was when the doctor is just like, does he have any other family? And there's just that close up on Pattinson being like, no, just me, you know, where he just realizes that he's all, you know, they're the only family they have together, and they've kind of been at odds a little bit through the movie.
Yeah.
Which, again, is something that I wish they explored a little bit more in it, because it's, I've shown this movie, I've introduced this movie to a couple of people, and each time it's been like, so why is he kind of a dick to Alfred? And I'm like, I can point to certain comics that they're trying to derive from, but I can't point to anything in the movie outside of, like, Alfred is kind of, you know, skeptical that this whole Batman thing is going to work.
I would just assume it's just being a spoiled rich kid kind of thing. That's how I kind of saw it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the Earth One comics and in the Zero Year comic, it is because of the fact that Alfred is more active in trying to get in Bruce's way. And it's very apparent, and Bruce even threatens to fire Alfred due to that in Zero Year. So, like, it's very clear in that, but they don't really have a moment like that. Like, they have a flat out fight in Earth One, you know, and that's not in the movie. And I'm not saying it should have been in the movie, but if it was, that would have definitely shown a little bit more of, like, what's going on, as well as, like, more clearly established this new version of Alfred, and this version of Alfred taught him how to fight and stuff. Because he kind of just has that one line about it, but he doesn't actually, like, he never fights during the movie.
No.
So.
Yeah, he's got a limp too, right?
Yeah, he's got the limp too, which is from the Earth One comics, it feels. So, moving further, a lot of people suspect that Hush is the next villain due to the reveal that Thomas Wayne played a role and had this whole Hush Money thing, and they literally had the words Hush in the, you know, during the whole Riddler thing, and we picked up on that. Honestly, I know you and I aren't super enthused about the idea, especially because it feels like repeated beats, but also I would say that Reeves was asked at one point who he would pick for another villain, and he did say Hush, but I think he's playing some 4D chess there, because, like, why would you reveal your cards like that? You know,
I know. I agree. I it's a little bit too easy. You know what? If that's what's in your heart, Matt Reeves, I want you to make a Hush movie. Mm-hmm. If that's really what you want to do, it's not what I would do. But, you know, if that's his vision, I'm going to respect his vision. Yeah. You know, I just think I'd rather have Mr. Freeze or Clayface or some shit in the next one. I know they're getting, like, a little bit more, you know, unrealistic, but I don't care. And also, a fucking freeze gun, not that fucking unrealistic, really.
I think Nolan's approach to the original trilogy, I think there was something to be said about the fact that each movie embodies a different type of movie. You know, the first one is like this epic origin story. Second one is like flat out crime drama. And then the third one, he doesn't try to repeat himself with Dark Knight. Like, you know, we have issues with Dark Knight Rises, but I got to hand it to Nolan. Like, he had the right idea of like, no, I'm not going to repeat myself. I'm going to do a completely different type of movie where it's like it's a hostile takeover type of thing. It's inspired by Battle of Algiers, inspired by like all these revolutions over the years.
Right.
It's an epic scope of the entire city, not like a Heat type of scenario. So I'm leaning to the fact that like if it's Hush again, we have what, another masked mystery man in this who's threatening Batman? Like we need another guy like this right afterwards. Like I think to continue the detective thing, there should be mysteries, but it shouldn't be like yet another masked guy comes out of the woodwork to threaten Batman and the city again, and he has to investigate again. You know, it should have some differences, just still be a mystery.
True.
But not be the same type of thing. Because I'm like, what, we're going to do Seven again as a Batman movie, just with Hush instead of the Riddler?
I mean, he's investigating Mr. Freeze, bro. And then all of a sudden he starts seeing owls. And like, what's going on with them? Yeah. And then the mystery, the plot thickens at that point. You know what I mean? So you still have your mystery there.
Yeah. But this is all to say that in the script, they do not actually say that the reporter's name was Edward Elliott. They do not drop the Elliott Easter egg. Okay. They have the Hush Easter egg in the script where it says Hush on the screen, but does not have Edward Elliott's name on that. I thought that was interesting. Yeah. And then there's an additional line from Riddler that's kind of a riddle, kind of a poem that I'm actually going to have you read, Andrew, in your Riddler voice. But it's kind of a clue in here. So take it away.
One by one, Gotham's pillars fall. On Judgment Day, the wreckage will consume us all.
Thank you.
Edward Nashton.
So this is kind of a clue to the Flood, right? Like it's built in. Whereas I think in the movie, there's not really any clues unless he does the fucking carpet thing and uncovers the plans. So it looks like a prior clue was put in here, but was taken out for whatever reason.
It still would have been so awesome if the Riddler's henchmen were starting to escalate out of Riddler's control, and the whole bombing was also kind of like the flooding of Gotham was like kind of not his idea. Really, you know, I always thought that would have been better. Like his followers kind of took it to a whole other level. It just spiraled out of control. So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I guess they took this out because it made it seem like it was too foreshadowing of what's going to happen. I don't know.
Yeah.
Also, the third act was probably rewritten the most. It really feels
that way. There's not a lot of indications, like, not to give too much away on this episode, but I don't have a lot on the third act to share. That's different on this one. So I think whatever changes they made, it was before this draft.
Right. Yeah. There's probably a lot of like the last few changes before shooting script, and maybe even during shooting a little bit.
I wouldn't really be surprised.
Feels like producer interference, man.
We need a big fight scene. I'm like, well, what about this mystery that Batman's supposed to solve? Like, it's should be
no sexy fighting at the end. Sexy fighting.
All right, fine. We'll just have him crash through and beat
I'm
up a bunch
from
of
Wall
Riddler
Street
demonstrators.
Yeah.
All right. Another thing that's interesting: Penguin is in the scene with Falcone when Bruce walks in, calls him Johnny Slick, you know, and walks away and stuff. And he's not in the script. Salute. Penguin is not in the scene in the script.
Salute to the greatest Falcone ever.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Let's just look at him.
John
Turturro, look at him.
Yeah. But, yeah, Farrell is... I'm saying I wouldn't be surprised if the reason why Penguin's in this scene, just in the beginning, is if Colin Farrell's already on set that day in the makeup, and they're just like, hey, you want to just come on for this scene? You're not in the script, but you can just throw in a couple lines as Penguin and do something. Yeah. Sure. So that's probably how that happened. Yeah.
He seems like with all the improv and like how much he got into, like he made a character out of this, like it just seems like he really enjoys this character.
Oh yeah, no, dude. Like this you know? HBO Max show, I'm looking forward to it because like this is he's gonna love this if he's it's because he knows this is the big showcase for stuff because his looks are all completely covered by that makeup.
Yeah.
It's a great showcase for the makeup. It's a great showcase for him as an actor. And I'm looking forward to seeing where they go off it. I mean, I think even people who dislike this movie, they still love Penguin. Like I've not met anybody who's just like, Penguin was shit. Like nobody has said anything bad about Colin Farrell's Penguin in this entire thing. At most, it's like it's kind of a boring design. They could have given him a monocle or something or an umbrella that has a gun, but that's not really on his performance or the characterization. That's just kind of on the realism of the world. But I've never seen anybody say that he was terrible or anything really negative about it compared to some of the other aspects of this movie that, you know, the internet always goes for the jugular for every single comic book movie on something.
Everyone likes Penguin and pretty much no one likes the Joker in this. You know, at least makeup wise.
Yeah.
It's just a makeup thing. Like his acting was fine. It's really just the design of that makeup, man. That's what it really boils down to. Dude. It's just really off putting. But yeah, like if you look at like a line like I ain't killed no Goyle, you know what I mean? Like, let's say Matt Reeves writes that line. Let's say it wasn't even improv. I ain't killed no Goyle. Like this fucking delivery, man. God, that must have been Colin Farrell's decision. Because they always say that acting is about decisions and creating a character with the script you've been given and doing as much as you can on your own without the director. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like, it just really, really feels like he really created a lot of this.
Yeah, it does feel that way. Like with reading the script too, it feels like if there's anybody doing improv, it's Colin Farrell. And if there's any character to do that with, it's this version. Because I think people like this character because he adds some levity to the whole thing. Like, I didn't have a problem with the tone, but if you did, like this, this is the guy who provides the laughs in it, and he does it in a way where it doesn't cheapen the drama. It doesn't.
It's the worst Spanish I ever heard.
It doesn't make it seem like suddenly we've gone into you know, cheesy humor mode. It's the earned humor.
El Rata Alada.
It's the only one who knows the difference between Alan Law. No hablo español, fellas.
It's the best. That's one of the best lines of the whole goddamn movie.
And it's also like a unique take on Penguin because most of the versions, he seems like, you know, like not every version is British, but like you understand why they make Penguin British sometimes because it seems like he talks with the demeanor of like, oh, I'm a gentleman and well-mannered. And instead they went in like full Sopranos mode.
Tony
Soprano being an influence on the performance here. And I'm like, well, that's not how I personally see Penguin, but I got to admit it works and it works damn well for this movie.
Yes, definitely. Still gangster shit.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it totally fits the gangster shit.
Yeah.
Some deleted moments here in the hospital scene with Alfred. Bruce and Alfred hold hands, which is pretty much what ends the scene before Bruce sees the bat signal. But in the script, Alfred has a line about how Bruce won't be rid of him just yet. And Bruce brings up that he went into his parents' room the previous night and how it now feels so much smaller, which is, again, one of those things where I'm like, this is a nice character moment. This is not the button to the scene.
Like, doesn't connect at all. Yeah,
it doesn't really. There wasn't really that big of a thing about his parents' room. There wasn't a scene where Alfred was just like, "You should go in one of these days. Why is there the lock here?" And like, they didn't really build that up. So I could see why they're like, "Let's just end it with him holding Alfred's hand," and that's the perfect end to the scene. They did right. They did the right decision for this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a process, man.
Yep.
Trying to find the right movie in all of this.
Yeah. Another deleted moment is Batman actually pulling up in the Batmobile across the street from the Iceberg Lounge to see Selina about to go in and try to take out Falcone. So I don't know why they cut that part, but presumably he changes into the Drifter outfit to infiltrate the club from there. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing, too, Selina does not claw Falcone's face in the script. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, weird.
That must have been a decision later on, but maybe not necessarily on that day. But
probably.
It's a great moment. It's one of those things where they brought the comic to life.
Yes, that's true.
Let's jump to the finale. Again, I don't have a ton on the third act other than when Batman gets shot by the shotgun. In the movie, it's just like, all right, he just gets saved by the armor. In the script, Jesus, it says that it went through his armor and we see, quote, buckshot in exposed skin. So
nice battle damage.
Yeah, he gets actual battle damage in that, which I think, I mean, that definitely would have really shown how hardcore he's having to fight through the pain when he injects himself in the next part and he has to save everybody and shit. Like he's fighting through all that through the rest of, because this guy doesn't go home to rest after he fights all the Riddler guys. He saves the people there. He brings them out. It's still fucking daylight when he's bringing, you know, all the survivors out over to the paramedics and the helicopters and stuff. Like, this guy has not had any single rest there this whole time. So that's one of those small things that I'm like, that could have been cool. But I mean, the whole beat is there where he's already shot. So it would have just been an added detail.
Right.
And lastly, again, guys, Batman is confirmed to inject himself with adrenaline in the script. There's no venom. There's no random comic book serum thing. It does say adrenaline, but it does say that it's to his neck, not to a designated spot in his leg. And I feel like they might have changed it because they're like, well, his cowl's supposed to be armored. His cowl's supposed to be bulletproof. It looks like leather, but it's supposed to be bulletproof. Whereas, you know, I think in the movie they built in, he's got like an injection site built in where he would have access for the needle to go through and into his skin, which I'm like, well, that would be something that Bruce would do.
Yeah, definitely. That's contingency.
Yeah. So after all that, is there anything, Andrew, that you feel like should have been kept in?
No, like you said, I feel like they kind of made all the right decisions. I was thinking maybe there was more with Alfred or something, because the Alfred stuff's really,
it gets skimmed. A short shrift, doesn't it? Yeah,
it gets short shrift in the final thing. So, you know, it's a testament to what they told us in film school. A film is made three times, once on paper, once while shooting, and once in the editing room. Mm-hmm. So, we've through our deep dives, we've kind of seen this happen, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the only thing that I think could have helped were like some of these small things that I've already mentioned, you know, like planting the padlock door earlier. Like more of the battle damage with the bat suit at the end. I mean, these other things, the Barbara Gordon shout out is a cool Easter egg, but it's not necessary. The Joker scene,
right?
I like it. Movie works well without it. Same thing with the Penguin moment with Selena, with him talking about his ambitions. Like, they're nice scenes that they made the right choices.
Definitely. Yeah, it's not a Batman Forever type situation. So.
Nope, not at all. If anything, it's just like, it's the first time where we're just like, no notes in terms of what they should have kept.
No notes. Yeah, you did good, Reeves, of course. Yep. I mean, I know I said that stuff about Barry's makeup, but other than that.
Yeah.
What can I say?
I mean, who pretty knows? Good. Maybe years from now, there'll be an earlier draft that leaks out that maybe has some of the stuff that addresses our issues that might have been, you know, maybe there's more Alfred scenes in earlier drafts. Maybe there's another payoff that I felt was missing to the glider shit. Like, maybe there's other stuff. But until then, that's superhero stuff you should know. In the meantime, big thanks to Dan for the visuals on this. Make sure to check out our $5 Patreon this week, where I included a lot of the smaller moments from this script that we didn't talk about in this episode. You know, moments in the script that made me notice new things in the movie when I looked back at it. So we'll cover that in this week's $5 tier. But till then,
nice.
Some of the comments that we got from Jose Daniel Gutierrez. Sorry if I butchered that. Says, do you know there are storyboards, I think you meant storyboards, of James Cameron's Spider-Man that you should have used in the video? Well, as we commented here, the only ones we could find were these fan-made storyboards from Daniel Tomasi, illustrated in 2001, paired with a scriptment in 2016, Tomasi being an Italian artist who storyboarded a lot of Cameron's scriptment. I wrote, while cool, we didn't want to confuse people into thinking they were the actual storyboards. Unfortunately, just given the nature of the internet, a lot of people have been bringing these storyboards out and passing them off as Cameron's own storyboards, but they were actually done by this fan, Daniel Tomasi, and we also highlighted a lot more of that in our $5 tier Patreon for the James Cameron stuff, where we got to sort of go over all the different storyboards that Tomasi illustrated. So check that out if you're part of the $5 tier. But thank you.
Thank you.
Over to here. Okay. This was one of my favorites. So,
hold on. I think the video is not up on the thing.
Oh, okay.
For the comments.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's
there we go. There it is.
So this is from Jose earlier on Cameron Spider-Man, but this is Captain Beastwinger. So just to give you some context, there is a storyline called Spider-Man Reign that is kind of supposed to be the Dark Knight Returns of Spider-Man, where it's supposed to be old Spider-Man. And at one point, it's revealed that in this possible depressing as fuck future, Mary Jane is dead due to the radiation of, I shit you not, Peter's radioactive sperm.
Oh my god, we don't need all that.
I know. So Captain
That's
Beastwinger,
like some edgelord shit.
Captain Beastwinger comments on our Cameron the 93 script saying, remember Spider-Man Reign where Wiener ends up killing Mary Jane? This guy just keeps killing Peter's loved ones.
Oh,
thank you, Captain
man.
Beastwinger. This is a winning comment.
Yes.
So,
oh my god.
And then last one, Man of Action commented on our Spider-Man coverage saying, with great power comes great responsibility, came from Uncle Ben's mouth in 1987. And later in 1994, Spider-Man the Animated Series, also David Koepp's Spider-Man script dated August 30th, 2000, says, based on a treatment by James Cameron. I think Cameron's name should have been in the movie as well. Thank you, Man.
I can't believe that wasn't from Stan Lee. I thought Stan Lee created that line.
He did create the line, but it is in the comic. It's just in the narration.
Yeah.
It's not directly said by Uncle Ben. That was I think Man of Action is pointing out is that it's directly said by Uncle Ben in pop culture. We always associate that with Uncle Ben, but he didn't actually say it in the original comic. It's only because later interpretations had it so that, and it makes a lot of sense that Uncle Ben is the one who tells it to him, and then Peter learns the lesson the hard way when Uncle Ben dies.
Yes.
Thank you, Man of Action.
Thank
you. Over to the shout outs.
All right, everybody. We want to thank everybody here, but some of the recent people such as Yusuf A, Kevin R, Derek O, Renee V, and Tita, and our other supporters as well. And that's it. So we've told you about our friends, and now we'd like you to do us a favor.
We want you to tell all your friends about us.
Yep.
Yep.
Oh!
It's going in.
God damn.
What happened?
Peanut just jumped out of nowhere. Oh my god.
It's on film.